Law's Cool, episode number 8.
Hi, I'm Jacob Kaufman. I'm a 1L here at University of Western Ontario.
And my name is Omar Hareda. I'm a first-year law student as well at the University of Western Ontario.
Now, Omar, I understand that we won an award.
More of a recognition, actually. Canadian Lawyer mentioned us as one of the top 10 law blogs in Canada, which was great considering we do this on a part-time basis with as full-time law students and very busy law students at that. So.
Yeah, so wow, shout out to all our contributors.
Definitely, and also congratulations to everyone else who won the award, as well as a number of honorable mentions that we listed on our site as well. Mm-hmm. So it's great to be part of the dialogue and the exchange, and that's what this is all about.
Canadian blogosphere.
That's correct, Canadian blogosphere.
It's a horrible word, blog. It's really, really an awful neologism. Sounds like something out of Dr. Seuss. Anyways,
So our first interview for this episode of Law's Cool is going to be with Mark Popiel, who's an immigration lawyer in Buffalo, New York. What we're going to try to do with the next few interviews in the next couple series is look at the internet and social media and things like that and how it's used in different areas of law and in legal practice. So Mark, doing immigration law, obviously tracks a lot of his clients through their website and through visibility on the internet. So let's listen into that now.
All right.
My name is Mark Popiel. I serve as senior counsel for a law firm by the name of Bond, Shinnick & King. The firm has 11 offices in the United States. We're primarily a labor business practice. My specialty is U.S. corporate immigration, and in particular, I represent typically small to multi-billion dollar corporations and provide counseling with regards to bringing in professional staff to provide services to various U.S. operations. I also, in many ways, facilitate movement of U.S. workers to other countries, in particular where I'm stationed in Buffalo, New York. Sometimes we facilitate sort of transfer of U.S. workers to Canada. And I primarily focus on, you know, doing temporary work authorization cases as well as permanent residency, which is the so-called green cards.
Okay.
So that's in a nutshell of, you know, what I do.
And Mark, how exactly does the internet play a role in your practice and what you do?
It gives me a greater exposure. Unlike other practices, which typically are constrained geographically, for instance, obviously being licensed in New York State, most attorneys have to focus on handling matters that are state-related or, you know, mm-hmm. Canada would be provincial. Immigration is a federal-based regulation, and so it gives me the ability to really practice nationwide, and that exposure actually goes well outside just the parameters of the country. I have clientele worldwide, so the internet really opens up the exposure in the field of clientele. Obviously, with time zones mm-hmm. and the clients I represent, internet helps because obviously folks can get a hold of me fairly quickly.
Okay,
so it works both ways for marketing as well as actually providing legal services where you can communicate with a particular client, even though it may be a different time in the U.S. Obviously, you know, you can use the internet to your advantage.
Now, would you say it's your firm's website is a primary resource that you're using in that sense then?
I would say yes for worldwide exposure. Mm-hmm. Word of mouth is also, I would say, a major component to my practice.
Okay.
Representing clients all over the world, I mean, a lot of times they run into colleagues who are at different, you know, corporations and so forth. And so that obviously is another level of the marketing that I have. But website does play a key presence.
What are some of the trends that you foresee?
I would say, you know, while we have seen, I guess I'll call it a restriction on travel, in particular with sort of the legislation requiring individuals to use passports, obviously that has been stayed temporarily, but I can see the trade continuing.
Okay.
Recent numbers indicate that somewhere around of $1.26 billion changes hands between the United States and Canada each day.
Mm-hmm.
It's inescapable to sort of not see that as a major component in you know, both countries as far as economics and so forth. And I see that developing further. You know, there are trade blocks that have developed worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely need to have trade partners. I mean, some may argue that that's harmful, but at the end of the day, I think to be competitive, you do have to sort of develop arrangements. And so in that regard, Internet comes into play. Movement of documents, it's much quicker these days for me to send a client a particular document to review via Internet versus mm-hmm. having to mail it and so forth. So times are becoming, in a sense, where things happen at a much rapid rate. And I see that to continue. I mean, the introduction of BlackBerries.
Yes.
Obviously, BlackBerry is a Canadian-based company that has given, in particular for me, I guess I'll call it a tether to my office, but given the nature of what I do, it gives me ability to be in tune and in contact with clients all the time.
Okay. Now, Mark, you probably don't know this, but I did my first degree in the U.S., and as a Canadian, I was actually working in the U.S. under a TN1 or work permit for my profession. Okay. But seeing how I'm now switching over to law, do you see opportunities for Canadian lawyers as well to be working in the U.S.?
Yes. NAFTA, which governs the TN category, has a carve-out for attorneys. One of the requirements you have to show is that you have a law degree,
mm-hmm.
And then there's the provisions under NAFTA stipulate that you may present a license to be able to practice, but there's no requirement. So having a law degree, Canadian lawyers could, in essence, go to an in-house position and work under a licensed attorney and be able to use the TN to their advantage. It's good in the sense that it's quick process at the border, or you may mm-hmm. process at the border. It's not necessarily costly these days. It costs $56 to mm-hmm. process for a TN. That's $50 processing fee and $6 to get a card called I-94 document. So, yeah, it definitely is a helpful sort of component.
Okay. And I'm looking at your background as well. Looks like you did your undergrad at Brock. Is that correct?
I did.
So are you Canadian as well?
I am.
Maybe you can explain a little bit about how you ended up in the States and why you made that decision to go
there. Sure. I did a history political science degree at Brock University in St. Mm-hmm. Catharines. Actually, I'm a Canadian. While doing my undergraduate studies, I decided that law was going to be something I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of, in taking courses during my undergraduate studies, I wanted to do international immigration law.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to look at the U.S. as a possibility just because of the market. It's much broader and so forth. So at the completion of getting my degree at Brock, I just, in essence, I applied to U.S. law schools.
Mm-hmm.
For that exact reason, that I just felt I was going to practice in the U.S.
And okay.
So it gives me, I think, a good background because I represent Canadian and U.S. clients. And so, you know, I think there are certain differences between the countries. And so I have an insight on both sides of the border.
Definitely. And it's great to see that Canadians are working on both sides of the border and doing
yeah.
such interesting work.
That's correct.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today. I'm sure listeners will find this interesting. Thanks a lot for your time.
Great. You're most welcome. All right. Bye-bye.
Now, next up is Ian Hall of Hall & Hall, and they're really on the cutting edge. They have a blog, podcast, videos, and they do estate planning and estate law.
That's right, and they're definitely one of the leaders when it comes to the use of the Internet. And Ian's going to talk about how some of their initiatives has really helped their practice.
Great, let's roll the tape.
Hi, I'm Ian Hull. I am an estates lawyer. I do predominantly estate litigation work, estate trust and capacity litigation work.
And maybe tell us a little bit about what your firm does in terms of podcasts and the Hull & Hull TV.
We at Hull & Hull are sort of venturing over the last year. We're both doing a lot of daily blogs, and we're doing two different separate weekly podcasts to sort of touch two different audiences. We do one podcast, which is Hull & Estates and Succession Planning, and I do that with my law partner, Susanna Popovic-Montag.
Mm-hmm.
And that podcast is one that is predominantly focused on more general, non-legal approach to issues that relate to estates. It's, I guess I would call it sort of a more broad-based audience that is listening to that. And the second podcast is focused on our referral source, and that is on lawyers and accountants and financial planners and advisors, and that focuses on specific, more legal-related issues.
Okay.
Like, for example, last week, Hullin Estates and Succession Planning, we did a podcast on what to expect as an executor and how do you organize things like the funeral.
Okay.
We talked about that, and then, but the contrast on the Hullin Estates was how we talked about the concept of proprietary estoppel and how it affects different claims. So that's a good example of how the different delineation is that one is much more legally focused and the other is more general information relating to estates.
So generally two different audiences is what you're targeting here.
Yeah, and it's funny, I find those who give me direct feedback on it, they typically will listen to both because what we're doing is, you know, sort of refreshing lawyers and accountants and others on more general issues as well.
Okay. Now, how did you get interested and involved in all of this?
I got involved because at the outset, my good friend Terry Follis, who is does inside PR and is in the PR marketing area, approached my brother-in-law. Terry is my, I guess how I related, my brother-in-law's twin brother. And so Terry and I were talking, and my brother-in-law were talking about this new concept. This was about, that was last March, so March 07. And I just thought it was a perfect idea for our niche practice.
Okay.
And he explained it to me, and away I went.
Great. And how has this changed your practice, or what changes have you seen in terms of your interaction with the legal community and with your clients?
Well, it's sort of done two things. The first thing, and to be perfectly honest, what really appealed to me was I wasn't sure if anyone was really going to listen other than my mother.
And
so I wasn't going into it really for the purposes of what it's how now turned out to be. But I went into it because we have 17 lawyers at this firm.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of estate-related work, only estate-related work, and it's a constant struggle and a bit of a battle to keep lawyers informed, internally even, and so on, recent developments, or to keep them fresh and to keep them on top of our game. We position ourselves in the marketplace as leading experts, and so I thought, geez, this is a great way to force people. When I first came out of law school and first started in this area of law, I learned quickly from my father is that he said to me, write books, write articles, that's how you learn.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a venue that allows young lawyers to get into it and to learn the product. And I think it's a lot easier at some level, too, because it's not quite as onerous as saying to someone, go write a book or go write an article. So it helped us internally at the outset. And that was my primary goal, because, as I said, I really wasn't sure how many people were going to listen.
Mm-hmm.
As it's turned out, my practice is and always has been a referral-based practice. I do a very finite type of work. I don't touch clients for any other purpose. So I get referrals from all sorts of different sources. And that referral source does the general estate work. They'll do an administration. They'll draft the will. They'll do the sort of work that we just don't do.
Okay.
Because we're more focused on the contentious side. So at that, the other aspect of it was a bonus, I thought, would be to impart some of our knowledge to that referral source. And as it's turned out, that's really worked out well. And based on the feedback, that's the core listeners on the Hullin Estates for sure are our referral source. So it's sort of like a newsletter
in
the old-fashioned way.
And what was the learning curve for you like in terms of getting into all of this?
Well, it was it wasn't bad. I do a lot of public speaking and a lot of talks to lawyers about different topics. So the concept of having to think on my feet about issues and things like that wasn't quite as daunting for me. But I'd had a lot of work in it. I know my partner Susanna Pavic-Montag was the same. So we kind of got off running. Now we were nervous at the start and felt that, you know, I mean, I sort of shudder when I think of my early podcasts in the sense that it was much more scripted and much more cut and dry, and I don't think it was as easy to listen to, but it was fundamentally good information.
Yeah.
So we were obviously nervous. First, probably 20 podcasts were more difficult, but we've sort of hit our stride. Now we're experimenting with different things and so on. So it hasn't been as much of a challenge. But I do know, like, because what we do is, and you know, we spread the work around, and so to speak, on the Holland Estates. It's split every week with two different lawyers in the firm. And so I like to get feedback from them, and they're still nervous, and they're still, they sort of feel the pressure of once you're on air, so to speak.
Well, you mentioned this nervousness, and I think that probably extends over to blogs as well. And I think in general, a lot of firms are reluctant to take on blogs, although that is changing. And do you think that those fears and concerns that firms have in terms of blogs are justified? And if so, how can those be addressed?
I think they're justified on two levels, but I think they're easily addressed. One of the things we were doing when at the outset, the early blogs, I was doing them, and it just became more like our blogs aren't, we're not a pure social media entity in the sense that it's hard for us to be interactive, because typically most of the feedback we get is someone seeking free legal advice, and that's just, it's awkward to do in a sort of a free environment in that sense, not just from a fee standpoint, but you can't just, you know, answer off the cuff on these things. So it was a little awkward at the start, but what we turned it into was more of a daily newsletter. And that isn't nearly as onerous, because what we do is we impart a sort of an interesting stat or an interesting fact or an interesting turn of events, try to keep it short and sweet, and we again spread it across the board so everybody participates. You're on for 1 week for blogging, that's your week.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have the heavy burden of the interactive that a lot of podcasting, a lot of blogging and podcasting would normally have.
Okay.
But it's a big undertaking, and it's also, you've got to be very careful, because like the podcasting, we're very sensitive to the fact that we're in the business of private information, and we cannot in any way, shape, or form share that private information, nor do we want to ever come close to it.
And so what type of, you know, editorial oversight do you provide, just to put in like some sort of checks and balances, make sure everyone's okay with what's going out there?
Well, what we've done is, and that's a big question for firms who get involved in this, and that what we do is for the blogs, they're always edited by a partner. So whoever's written it, someone else edits it.
Okay.
So that there's another set of eyes just to make sure we haven't said something we shouldn't say. And with the podcast, a partner is always podcasting with an associate. So we have four partners. You know, between all of us, we just spread that work around, and we're all pretty comfortable. We're certainly all comfortable with each other, and that way we've been able to control it so that something doesn't ever, not that we want it to, but if there are no mistakes then.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Sure. I think, well, it's interesting. I mean, I've now gone to a conference, Podcasts Across Borders, 2 years in a row now, and they've got their third one coming up. And I remember going to the first one just after I started doing this podcasting and blogging. And I think literally we were getting 14 listeners on our podcasts.
Okay.
And at the time, and thinking to myself, geez, you know, I've been doing it now for a couple of months. How can this possibly be worthwhile? And now the stats don't drive me aren't that important, but we're almost at 100 podcasts on both Holland Estates and Holland Succession Planning. We've been daily blogging since then, and the feedback is unbelievable, and it's almost daunting now what our numbers are, and not just because numbers matters, but also the impact in the legal community. I mean, we're seen as innovative. Young lawyers who want to get involved in our practice and so on see this as a positive. It brings along with it an umbrella of benefits that at first you wouldn't even consider. You know, I was at a meeting the other day, and the lawyer on the other side was there, and the client across the table, and the client looked at me and goes, "Hey, I've been listening to your podcast." And I'm thinking to myself, you know, that's great. Even the enemy are listening. So it's great, and it's been very rewarding. And I think lawyers are more often than not, technology dinosaurs, and they're not embracing this as much as they should, and I think they're missing out, quite frankly, because it's got to be the wave of the future in terms of imparting your personality, and personality plays a part of the retainer. And I don't, you know, I think people know me a little bit before they come to see me now, and those are the sorts of benefits that you just can't, there's no other way to give that benefit, you know, to impart mm-hmm. that information unless you're doing this sort of thing. So although it's a daunting start, once you get rolling, it's a lot of fun.
Well, that's good news for those of us involved at Law is Cool.
Yeah.
Is there anything you could possibly, I mean, if you've had a chance to look at our blog or our podcast, any advice you'd like to give us?
I've really enjoyed it. I think you guys are doing a fantastic job. What I really am intrigued by is the issues that you're hitting. And it's an easy source to get. You guys are touching some great hot buttons that are making people think. So I love it. It's busy. That's the only thing I would say.
So, yeah.
You know, but it's, I guess that's part of the fact that you guys are all excited about it and there's lots going on.
Well, Ian Hull, thank you very much for talking to us today. We really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. Best of luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Great. Now, there is a darker side to internet and the law, and a lot of it comes with the social networking website Facebook. Jesse Hirsch, who I believe we're both friends with, although I'm only a friend with him on Facebook, I never actually met him in person, he testified in a case called Aaron Sothern. Now, in this case, a man made several threatening updates on his Facebook website, which could be construed that he was threatening the Children's Aid Society. And they found this, and he was charged.
There's a lot of controversy over Facebook these days, that's for sure.
Yeah, now the judge concluded that the remarks were not actually threatening, and quoted Mr. Hirsch saying that people who profile themselves embellish their character. They deliberately say provocative things to elicit a response from their Facebook friends. So in a sense, they construct an alternate persona.
So did the judge in this case actually say that it wasn't really considered a threat then?
Mm-hmm. He said that he found him not guilty, but he did say he knew why the cops and the Children's Aid took this very seriously.
Yeah, why
and
they
said
had
he
concern.
Would not fault them.
Okay.
But he said at the end of the day, he could not convict him.
That is interesting.
Because of those statements. It's interesting. There are only a few cases have mentioned Facebook so far, and some of them don't seem quite to understand what Facebook is. One refers to it as an online chat facility, a computer program, but in most of these cases, people are putting up pictures on their Facebook that maybe they shouldn't put up.
Yeah.
You know, people were in various tort cases, and they're doing things in their Facebook pictures that maybe they're saying they wouldn't. So I think it's all about people think they're have a lot more privacy than they do on the internet. Yeah.
You know, and again, that's one of the things we do on our site as well. We do get a lot. We have received threatening comments and comments that are actually quite inappropriate.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that they're not anonymous when they're doing those types of things.
Well, I don't think people would say that to us if they were in the same room as us. Now, Jesse, you're actually doing an event with Jesse, aren't you?
That's right. Yeah, upcoming this Tuesday evening, we're going to be talking about some of the effects of internet and social media and politics, etc. So it's sort of a gathering of some of the people who are involved in the field.
Wow.
At the Mars Center. We'll post the link to that.
Oh, sounds interesting. Too bad I have to be in London.
Well, I'm sorry you couldn't be there as well, Jacob. Other than that, I guess this will probably be our last episode of Law School for the season.
Exams coming up.
Oh, yeah. Don't tell me about it.
So
we're going to all be probably buckling down and getting to work with that, probably not giving as much attention to the blog as we would like. So I guess our readers can expect far less frequency. But there is something else they should keep an eye out. Among the Law School team, we're actually trying to identify an individual who's provided unique contribution to the team over the past year, and we're going to make that announcement within the next week or so as well. So keep an eye out for that.
For all the students who are going to be going into law next year, you might want to check out being a contributor to this blog yourself.
Definitely.
We could use to, you know, pass the torch to the next generation.
That'd be great. People who are interested in that, please do contact us at admin@lawischool.com, and we can discuss really what the responsibility entails and how you can get involved.
We'd be glad to have you.
That'll be all for this episode of Law School, and I hope you guys enjoyed the first season.
You stay classy, Internet.